We open our Bibles again to Proverbs chapter 9. What we have before us, Proverbs chapter 9, is the last part of an extended introduction to the rest of Proverbs. There are 31 chapters in the whole book, chapters 1 to 9. That's the extended introduction. They deal with the momentous importance of wisdom, the momentous importance of wisdom. And then chapters 10 to 31, the chapters that follow, they deal with the practical outworking of wisdom in all of life. The practical outworking of wisdom in all of life. A lot, but not all of chapters 10 to 31 is made up of standard proverbs. You know, those short, memorable sayings capturing the ways of wisdom, often in contrast to the ways of its polar opposite. Foolishness, or in our chapter, the ways of folly. For our purposes this evening, chapters 1 to 9 show us three things. Chapters 1 to 9 show us three things. I need to nail these down before we proceed. First, the first thing that chapters 1 through 9 show us is this. First, wisdom and folly are matters of life and death, heaven and hell. The short, memorable sayings and everything else with them in chapters 10 to 31, they aren't just clever moralisms. Wisdom and folly are matters of life and death. In this world and this life and the afterlife too. The second thing that chapters 1 to 9 show us is this. Wisdom and folly are inseparably connected to fearing or not fearing God. Wisdom and folly are inseparably connected to fearing or not fearing God. Let's put it more strongly. There is no wisdom, there is no true wisdom where God is not feared. If the mention of heaven and hell in connection with wisdom turns heads, you know, we will live as we please. Thank you. If the mention of heaven and hell in connection with wisdom turns heads, the claim that there is no wisdom, no true wisdom, without or where God is not feared, that raises temperatures, doesn't it? You saying there's no wisdom where God isn't fear, people scoff. Not really, Solomon would answer. Correctly relating to God is foundational to wise living. Now that leads us to the third thing that chapters 1 to 9 show us. We're dealing with this because chapter 9 is the end of the extended introduction to what are pages upon pages of proverbs or proverbial sayings. The third thing chapters 1 to 9 show us is this, and we're building up here, all right? Wisdom is more than just a quality to be sought. Wisdom is more than just a quality to be sought. The presentation of wisdom as a woman with goddess-like qualities in chapter 9 and also incidentally in chapter 8, the presentation of wisdom as a woman with goddess-like qualities isn't just a literary device. reading backwards from where we are in world history with a complete Bible and a fully revealed Christ, woman wisdom is nothing less than Christ in one of his many stage personas that he takes on in the pages of the Old Testament. Woman wisdom is Christ offering life in its fullness under one of its chief blessings. Wisdom. So that's chapters 1 through 9 together. What about chapter 9 itself? As I said, Proverbs chapter 9 is the last part of an extended introduction. It and everything that comes before it, chapters 1 through 8, everything that comes before it, they flavor what follows. Chapter 9, looking at chapter 9 itself, this is actually Solomon's final climactic appeal. It's deliberately designed to provoke thoughtful and serious reflection. Solomon's final between the lines message is this: be careful who you listen to. Be careful what you choose. I have 3 points. First, two invitations and two feasts. Notice the structure to the chapter. We read it earlier. Verses 1 to 6 up at the top and verses 13 to 16 at the bottom are obvious counterparts to each other. But they're more than just bookends. They're more than just bookends. They are, think dumbbells. They compare two invitations to two feasts. They compare invitations from and feasts offered by two rivals. Two rivals interested in the lives and the eternities. Remember, that's stamped over the book of Proverbs, or at least it should be stamped over the book of Proverbs. These two rivals are interested in the lives and the eternities. It's not just about this life. It's not just about moral living. These rivals are interested in the lives and the eternities of men and women, boys and girls, but not in the same way. Verses 1 to 6 describe wisdom's feast and invitation. Down at the bottom, verses 13 to 18 describe folly's invitation and feast. I reversed the order there, didn't I? That's the order in the text. We'll see why. And then verses 7 to 12, those are the verses in between. Verses 7 to 12 unsettle Bible experts. And that's not because of what they say, it's rather how they relate to the two end pieces, verses 1 to 6 and verses 13 to 18. Now, I don't know. I honestly don't know what Solomon intended. But I'm going to suggest that verses 7 to 12 look like a taster. We're dealing with a feast, all right? This is a taster. A taster of what wisdom offers at her feast. In other words, the tray comes out the door, the front door, and is offered to those who are called upon. It's a taster. Now, her feast, we see this from the taster, her feast is about a lot more than food and drink, isn't it? Her feast is ultimately about instruction for life and eternity. She says as much in verses 4, 5, and 6. Let's read them again. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. To him who lacks sense, she says, come and eat of my bread and drink of the wine I have mixed. Leave your simple ways and live. And life in the book of Proverbs, indeed life across the Old Testament, when it's invested with salvific, redemptive significance, always bursts out of this life. This life cannot contain the life that God promises. All right? Wisdom's feast is ultimately about instruction for life and eternity. Verses 4, 5, and 6 say as much, but verses 7 to 12 simply offer more detail. We'll get to it. It's a taster of the curriculum. I'm allowed to mix metaphors. Solomon does. Now, folly wouldn't dare to offer a taster. Her cover would be immediately blown. We'll come back to this. So first, two invitations and two feasts. Secondly, the rivals and their offers. And here we're going to work vertically down the text. The rivals and their offers. Wisdom first. The picture painted in verses 1 to 6 is a picture of, here come a string of words, I'll unpack them. It's a picture of personal, ready, generous, open and welcoming, and also upfront and honest hospitality. I know that's a string of words. We'll work through them in order. First of all, personal. Personal. Wisdom's offer is personal. Notice, wisdom's venue is our home. It's her home. Wisdom has built her house. The pillars in that house, the decorative pillars, that's what we're talking about here. They're not so much structural as decorative. The pillars, the decorative pillars are, notice it again, her pillars. I'm relying on you often to look at the text. I won't read it all the time. The food on offer. Slaughtered beasts. The drink on offer, mixed wine. They're hers too. She prepared them. And the young woman she sends out are, look at it again, her young woman. And the message they carry is her message. Notice how verse 4 says, she says, not they say. We read in Ephesians, don't we, that Christ preached peace to those who are near and those who are afar off. He never went to Ephesus. He speaks in his messengers, in his people, through his people. The message that those young women carry is her message. She says, it doesn't say they say. And notice how verse 5 speaks of my bread and the wine I have mixed. In other words, the servant girls aren't speaking for themselves. I'm saying it again. Wisdom speaks through them. A quick aside. Do you hear Christ in us, his servants, as we issue his warm invitation? And that's not just from pulpits. That family member who appeals to you. The friend in the office. Now let's not miss the wood for the trees. What wisdom offers is her offer. It's not another's offer. How much of what turns your head is shoplifted? Stolen. I know I'm using strong language, but I mean it. How much of what turns your head is shoplifted, stolen, poached, plagiarized, borrowed? Where from? From truth and from God. But incompletely and also unlawfully. And I'm referring to the things that work after a fashion and temporarily. They work simply because they have a foot, one foot in God's world and God's wisdom, but only one foot, and it's a bad foot. Nobody survives underwater with a lookalike set of scuba gear. Beware what you fall for. Half-truths damn. So, first of all, wisdom is personal. Secondly, she's ready. She's ready. Wisdom's offer is ready. She doesn't just promise future returns. Notice, she has built her house. She has hewn her seven pillars. She has slaughtered her beasts. She has mixed her wine. Solomon's saying something here. She has set her table. And she has sent out her young woman. Are you getting the message? Six times we read, has. This feast is there to be enjoyed now. You'll understand me. From Christ. Now. Thirdly, she's generous. Wisdom's offer is generous. It's generous in every respect. There's an attractive venue and there is lavish catering. I thought of APC and our after baptism presentations at the back. Catering. Carol service. It's keep to Solomon. Notice, the venue is perfectly decorated. The venue is perfectly decorated. There are seven pillars. That's the complete number. There's a bit of code in here. And the hostess has, as we say, gone to town on the catering. She has slaughtered her beasts. And the Hebrew is apparently intensive. Literally, she has slaughtered her slaughter. And then the wine isn't just wine. It's mixed wine. Either got honey or herbs or spices, perhaps all three in it. And what do those three things do? Or just one of them? They up the taste and they possibly also up the potency. Did I say that in Christian circles? That comes at a price. This isn't off-the-shelf stuff. She has mixed her wine, it says. There's another price, not just the cost of the ingredients. There's the cost of personal investment. Personal investment. And then finally, notice the words, she has also set her table. She has also set her table. In other words, what's laid out is a visual feast. It's an eye popper. You will have noticed that Folly goes out to give her invitation. Wisdom stays in. Why? Wisdom sends her young people out not because she's lazy. There were things to do. She's been busy. Fourthly, open to all and free. Open to all and free. Wisdom's offer is open to all and free. Another word for open is indiscriminate. No qualifications. Look at verses 5 and 6. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. To him who lacks sense, she says, come eat of my bread and drink of the wine I have mixed. Leave your simple ways and live and walk in the way of insight. Now, I'm not trying to be cheeky, and I'm not trying to be rude, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful, certainly not to the Lord and to His Word, but that's a low bar. The simple and those who lack sense are welcome. Me. You. And for free. I have a personal test in me poem. It ends with this verse. What's the greatest lesson I have learned? I'm plagiarizing Joseph Hart at the end. All right. What's the greatest lesson I, Simon Doyle, have learned? Salvation's all of grace. It can't be earned. It has no price. It's offered free to Paul the killer. The killer's not in there. To Paul, to Magdalene, to me. Finally, fifthly, honest and upfront. Honest and upfront. Wisdom's offer is honest and upfront. There's no small print, no small print. And there are two things worth pointing out here. First of all, while wisdom's invitation in verses 5 and 6, that invitation is open to all and it's free, it doesn't flatter. While Christ warmly welcomes sinners, he doesn't flatter them. Many of you are offended by the gospel when the gospel is preached truly and fully. Christ warmly welcomes sinners. He doesn't flatter them. We're not in a position to be flattered. And the honest amongst us want honesty, not flattery. Flattery is no help when one's state is terminal. We are simple. We do lack sense. And those are actually very kind words. Gentle words for what is a fatal condition. Far worse could have been said. That's the first thing that's worth pointing out. Wisdom doesn't flatter, even while being welcoming. But secondly, there's a second thing worth pointing out. The taster, that's those in between verses. Verses 7 to 12. The taster that wisdom offers says things as they are, with first things first. And that's because there's a number of things that are absolutely essential to getting into and then benefiting from her feast. And the first is teachability. Verses 7 to 9 first. Okay, verses 7 to 9 first. We'll read this in its entirety. Whoever corrects a scoffer, that's a mocker, gets himself abuse. And he who reproves a wicked man incurs injury. Do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he will love you. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be still wiser. Teach a righteous man, and he will increase in learning. Now, there's a lot of things in those words, but teachability, or the lack of it, is prominent. The second thing that's absolutely essential is the core course that all must attend and pass. Verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. No growing in wisdom, no growing in knowledge, or rather insight. No growing in wisdom and no growing in knowledge, and then the insight that follows without, you could tell me, fearing the Lord. Now, we have stereotypes of that, don't we? Built on myths and ignorance. Far from being stifling or suffocating, fearing and knowing God are life-enriching and also life-lengthening. Look at verse 11. For by me your days will be multiplied and years will be added to your life. I won't develop on these things, all right? Here's the third thing. Verse 12. Wisdom's taster. The taster on the tray. It ends strangely, doesn't it? Verse 12. All right? It's the very last part of the, could we call them terms and conditions? All right? Just the terms and conditions of this offer, which is free. It has no cost. The third part of the terms and the conditions say this: if you are wise, you are wise for yourself. If you scoff, you alone will bear it. What's going on here? I think it's actually very simple. Each will get what they choose. Do I need to repeat that? Each will get, let's make it present. Each gets what they choose. So that's wisdom. Personal, ready, generous, open to all, and free, and then honest and upfront. Now we turn to folly. The polar opposite. And there's a lot less on her, isn't there? She doesn't offer a taster. She wouldn't dare. Indeed, she doesn't even offer a peek behind her front door. Not up front. We do get to peek behind her front door. Because Solomon knows she won't give us a peek behind her front door because it's too risky. It's not in her interests. It's not in the interests of the false offers you're entertaining at the moment either. To give you a taster and give you a peek behind the front door. So there's less about folly, but what's said isn't unimportant. Let me put it this way. It's not less important. Remember what I pointed out. There's this deliberate symmetry to the chapter on its outer ends. Not bookends, but dumbbells, indicating equal importance while also inviting comparison. You have to have a pretty poor memory to get down to those end verses and having forgotten the front lot. Inviting comparison. And in this respect, folly is nothing less than, and this is worse, sorry guys, you'll be able to trim my language in your own time. Folly is nothing less than attention-seeking and brash, beguiling, indolent and self-important, deceitful, and I really struggled to find a word for the next one, praying, and that's E, not A, praying, in other words, active in predation. You'll see what I mean when I get there. And then the last two are exploitive and deadly. Now remember, the allegory is real. Folly stands for every false offer of life and fulfillment. Some of these will be really quick. All right, attention seeking and brash. Verse 13, just the first part. The woman folly is loud. Beguiling. Continuing in verse 13, she is seductive and knows nothing. She's tempting, perhaps better, bewitching, all right? And she's ignorant. That's why she has to use her rival's strap line, something we will get to. It, using her rival's, or rather it, her loudness, and using her rival's strapline, more her loudness. Her loudness perhaps explains the reason why she's loud. Those who know least often shout the loudest, and my conscience kicks in because I am loud, aren't I? All right, hopefully not folly's way. Those who know least often shout the loudest, not so much to be heard, but rather as a cover, or perhaps an outlet for unrealized wants. Now, truth raises its voice at times, but truth is never loud, because truth's cause is secure. So attention-seeking and brash, and then beguiling. The third one, where wisdom is industrious and self-sacrificial, and she is. Folly is indolent and self-important. Verse 14, she sits at the door of her house and takes a seat on the highest places of the town. Fourthly, she's deceitful. Where wisdom offers a real venue, it's interesting that Folly's house isn't described because it's just a facade. It's a deceit. It's like those film set frontages we see, you know, the Wild West frontages. You open the door and there's nothing behind, just desert or whatever is where that frontage is placed. No house. Now, we'll get behind Folly's door shortly. For the moment, maybe Folly needs to sit at her door as well as seat herself in the high places, but it does say she sits at her door. She needs to guard it lest anybody gets in and exposes her charade. When you are offered an offer and there's secret stuff about it, turn tail and run. That's not the gospel's way. It's not Christ's way. Paul says, this has not been done in a corner at one point. All open, all to see. Fifthly, while wisdom's invitation is fervent, and it is fervent, it's sincere. Now let's turn to Folly. Folly, on the other hand, she prays, small e, verse 15, on those who pass by who are going straight on their way. And apparently the sense of the Hebrew is trying to intercept passers-by who are minding their own business. So sixthly, exploitive. Folly is exploitive, and she's exploitive in two ways. This is going to be a bit longer. First, she exploits another's invitation. Verse 16, whoever is simple, let him turn in here, and to him who lacks sense, she says. And then she also elbows in on the same locations. Up to verse 14 again, just jump up a bit, the highest places of the town. That's where the similarities end. And then things quickly change, all right? And here we're moving into the second way in which she is exploitive. You'll pick it up. Things quickly change. Verse 17, stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. False offers of life and salvation, meaning in this life, they do much the same thing. All right? Don't be duped by the branding and the label. It might not be a Rolex, as one of my working colleagues found out from an expensive watch he bought in the souk in Istanbul. Folly uses exactly the same opening words, but she means something quite different. There's no word about life and learning, no word about increasing insight. No, and here's her second point of exploiting, or rather the second way in which she exploits. Folly appeals to our baser instincts and values. Stolen water is sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. Folly appeals to the baser instincts and the baser values of fallen men and women, boys and girls. And that's actually how it plays out in real life, doesn't it? In the marketplace of life offers. Superficially, it appears as though something genuine is being offered. But there are fundamental differences. First, the values appealed to are at heart less than honorable. And then secondly, what's actually being offered is itself base and dishonorable. And Folly's invitation works. The false offers of false gospels, they work because, as I said, they appeal to our baser instincts and values. Now, it's worth pausing briefly on Folly's words in verse 17, because it's far too easy to say, not me. I'm not in Solomon's, or rather Folly's, target group. Stolen water is sweet and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. Who would openly promote stolen water and secret bread? Who, in all honesty, would promote stolen water and secret bread? Well, folly does. And who takes up such offers? You and me. You see, as shocking as folly's words appear, they actually capture things that are commonplace among people, otherwise normal and even respectable people, like you and me, but at the same time fallen and sinful. Like what, you ask? Well, let's try and just tease out a bit of what stolen water that sweet is. Surely it's just simply the patently unlawful but sweet. What about bread eaten in secret? Surely that's just the embarrassingly wrong, but at the same time pleasurable. Those things we wouldn't want anyone else to know about. Sometimes things that are just in our heads. Shall I give you some examples? I'm going to stick, or rather trace out the less obvious rather than the obvious, because you're more than able to identify the obvious in folly's words. First of all, let's deal with the patently unlawful, the patently unlawful, the patently sinful, all right, but still sweet. How about shortcuts to personal gain at cost to others? There's a reason the City of London has a reputation, and many other places across the face of the earth, and certain corporations that don't have headquarters in London or any of the big cities. The rat race, dog eating dog, the weakest link. What about fostering a reputation in others' eyes that you don't deserve? What about the shortchanging of clients, the tax man, employers, family and friends, and ultimately God? And not just in kind, but in truth. What about shamelessly enjoying God's bounty, but as trespassers? And I'm talking about living on stolen capital. Shoplifted blessing, as it were. God's common grace and kindness to you while pretending he doesn't exist or actually thumbing your nose at him. Now, I'll leave you to work that one out in further detail as well as the ones that preceded. Secondly, the embarrassingly wrong but still pleasurable. The embarrassingly wrong but still pleasurable. That's why we keep on doing it again and again and again. I'm talking about things like, or I'm going to suggest things like stewing bitterness. How about festering anger and the planning of revenge? Impure thoughts, impure acts, impure behavior. What about viciously self-centered ambitions under a cloak of politeness and decency? I'm talking about, or I'm suggesting things we would not only blush at if others found out, but in some cases we would wish we were dead. The issue is this, and I must move on. Folly knows the human heart. Folly knows the human heart. We to an extent, know our own parts, but we don't know the depths, and we only know our own hearts because of the blessed Holy Spirit who uncovers us to ourselves, because he knows it all. Folly knows the human heart. She knows its appetite. She knows its weaknesses. Her language, as shocking as it is belittling, isn't it? It's belittling language. It's also inciting language. We see it on the TV. We hear it in the workplace. Some of our family members use it. Sadly, some of us have used it. Come on, it might be wrong, but it's sweet. She says, and we say too. Yes, it's debased, but it's pleasurable. What, after all, can be wrong about what tastes good and what satisfies? Seventhly, folly is deadly. We're getting there. Penultimate point, really. We're getting there. Folly is deadly. Verse 18 now. You see, folly has presented her bait. There's an unseen hook in it, isn't there? And a fatal end. But he, that's the one who falls for her invitation, her deception, and heads for her door. He does not know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of Sheol. We've gotten behind her door. We're seeing what she doesn't want us to know. What's on the other side of that door? It's death and an unthinkable eternity. An awful afterlife is obviously in view. Look at the words, the dead are there. Her guests are in the depths of Sheol. My last point. It's short. What is Solomon's point? Why is careful and arresting composition? Why such imagery? Appealing and enticing imagery in the first instance, and then shocking and blunt imagery in the second instance. Why? There are ultimately only two calls. There are ultimately only two offers. There are ultimately only two ways to live, two ways to die, and two eternities to enter. Be careful who you listen to. Be careful what you choose. Choose wisdom. Choose Christ. Choose life.